If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. My name is Ed Newcomer. I'm the host of Nature Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. Our guest today is Sean Carnes, coming to us all the way from his home in, get this, Lusaka, Zambia. So, Sean, thank you so much for joining us. It's so great to have you here. And thank goodness we live in the era we do, and we can just talk to you in real time from Zambia.
It's very cool, Ed. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm looking forward to this, and should be a good time.
Me too. This is going to be a good story, and for a lot of reasons. Hey, let me just give you a little bit of background about who you are, and then if I forget anything, you can add to it. But for our listeners, you know, sure. I want people to know, you know, Sean is a former wildlife officer with the state of Tennessee. So up to now, our guests have been federal agents from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But Sean was a state wildlife officer, so like a state game warden. For many, many years, he worked on a lot of undercover cases. He has a very good reputation as an undercover officer, working with the feds, working on state cases, federal cases, the whole deal. Sean and his wife, Stephanie, are also founding directors of the Wildlife Investigators Training Alliance, WIDA, which provides training to wildlife officers around the world. Sean, so great to have you. I know it's in the evening there in Zambia, but did I leave anything out about your background?
No, that's plenty. You know, I've just been so fortunate to work with so many dedicated agents and investigators and officers over the years. I just hope that this segment can do justice by all their hard work as well.
Oh, I guarantee it will. This is fascinating because this is something we're going to come back to during this series of Nature Secret Service, and that is this issue of caviar trafficking. And, you know, I'm sure all of our listeners know and understand that caviar, in its most basic sense, are fish eggs. And, you know, at the high end, they can be a delicacy, and they're very sought after, particularly in certain ethnic communities. But we all know of, you know, the classic James Bond in his tuxedo enjoying some beluga caviar somewhere. Beluga caviar, as a particular type of fish, comes from sturgeon, a type of sturgeon called the beluga. It's only found in the Caspian and Black Seas, and it's been under a lot of pressure for many years. It's an endangered animal. So I'm just going to give a little bit of background, Sean, to lead you into your story. And then we're just going to jump right in because, Sean, you have amazing experience working on caviar trafficking cases. So basically, what we're talking about by the, let's say, into the mid-1990s, the really popular sought-after caviars were coming out of Eastern Europe. And those fish stocks started to be depleted dramatically. So supplies were getting short. The beluga sturgeon is a fish that can live, I don't know, hundreds of years, I think. Over 100 years, for sure. They mature
like a dinosaur.
Yeah, they look like a dinosaur, too. They're big. They can get to be, you know, 5, 6, 7 feet long. And they live a long time, and they mature late in life. So the females aren't, you know, producing eggs, you know, in mass until they're pretty old. Anyway, so the fish stock starts to be depleted by the mid-1990s, so it's becoming more and more rare. It becomes listed by CITES and protected under the Convention on International Trade of Endangered Species, and eventually is listed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as endangered under the Endangered Species Act in the U.S. All of that starts to make a legal requirements that make it hard to trade in caviar. And this causes the people who are profiting from caviar to look for alternative sources. And this is how a wildlife officer from the state of Tennessee gets connected with caviar. So now I want to jump to where you start to get involved, Sean. And basically that your involvement starts with being around a fish called the paddlefish, right?
Yep.
So yep. tell me and, how, so what, number one, what is a paddlefish and where are they found? Native. They're native to the U.S., but where are they found and what is it?
Certainly. They're pretty much contained within the drainage of the Mississippi River system. So they'll find them as far west as Glendive, Montana, and as far east as in, they actually made it into the rivers of Pennsylvania. So, you know, if you think of everything or look at a map of the United States and you see that massive drainage of the Mississippi River, that's primarily where paddlefish occur, is throughout that drainage. Also, I must say, though, there are species of sturgeon as well that occur there.
Okay.
And some of those sturgeon were already federally endangered or listed as threatened with no harvest. They were primarily contained, the sturgeon that we would encounter, or American sturgeon, were contained in the Mississippi as well as up the Ohio River. So the real interesting thing about this with regards to paddlefish, yes, sought after species. And before, I guess probably it's in the 80s, there began to be an industry for the American paddlefish.
And it
started in the state of Tennessee.
So the paddlefish, number one, it's a very unique looking fish, right? Describe what a paddlefish looks like.
Sure. You know, a large flat bill that's long, and they're a filter feeder. So they have the ability to go along, open up this large mouth and move around and utilize their rostrum or their big spatula looking nose as like a sensor. And, you know, they as well don't have bones like sturgeon. So they're cartilaginous, and they're another prehistoric dweller.
Right.
And they can get quite massive. I mean, over 100 pounds, but, you know, not so much in recent years due to overfishing.
Interesting. You know, you mentioned American sturgeon. When we talk about caviars, people often associate it with those Eastern European fish, the beluga sturgeon, the Acetra sturgeon, Sevruga. But there are a lot of sturgeon in the U.S. actually. On the West Coast, of course, there are sturgeon in the Columbia River, and even in California, in the Sacramento River, there are sturgeon located there. So they're not, you know, it's not a non-native fish necessarily. Those are different species, of course. But so right. What historically, what was the fishery for paddlefish? Was it for meat or eggs, or what was the, you know, prior to what we're going to talk about today, what is the managed fishery for paddlefish? Why would people fish for them?
So throughout numerous southeastern states where paddlefish occurred, there was a limited fishery for the meat. Okay. But a lot of times they were just seen, I hate this term, but as a junk or a trash fish. It was a non-regulated species occurring with not much interest other than local consumption and some, you know, some shipment of meat after it would go to a fish house and then subsequently to a fishmonger. But there was just not a huge demand. This dealer in Tennessee had the occasion to meet some folks from New York that were originally from former Soviet bloc countries that he began to do business with them.
So let me back up
this
a little
would
bit.
Have been in the 80s.
Okay, so let me back up a little bit. So traditionally, though, it would have been local people who were just interested in fishing for them. Not much of a necessarily commercial market, but just
right.
Okay, enough that it was novelty. Right. It wasn't causing a problem for the population of the fish, as you mentioned. They were unregulated. They were considered common. So, but that starts to change, right? At some point, that starts to change, and more pressure start to put on these fish. So, how did it come to your attention that there could be a problem or an issue with paddlefish? What happened?
You know, the craziest thing, I started this work in 1994 and in the state of Mississippi. The state of Mississippi had no legal harvest of paddlefish whatsoever. Hmm. It was totally closed in protected waters. At that point in the investigations unit in Mississippi, we began to have some complaints that there were people from Tennessee, buyers, that were dealing with people because of the demand was increasing so much that they would go risk their necks and solicit these folks in an entirely closed state to catch paddlefish. They taught them how to process the roe because it's a very timely process, has to be done very soon. And ultimately, there were a group of people in Mississippi who I had the occasion to begin to interact with on an undercover basis and learn that, hey, those folks from Tennessee are coming down here, those buyers, they're driving the prices. There's a hell of a demand and we're willing to take the risk. The dealers have ways to cover it. And it was also fascinating to learn. So I began to look into it.
Okay.
And right about this time, I had the opportunity to relocate to Tennessee, which being from the northeastern U.S. originally, I'm fond of hills. And so it was a great opportunity. And I had been working in conjunction with joint operations with Tennessee, but I made the move to Tennessee.
So you were part of the plan with that. You were a Mississippi officer before?
Yeah.
Okay, yep. I didn't know. If I knew that, I forgot. I apologize. So you started with the state of Mississippi. Okay. All right.
Yeah,
so you make your
water though. I came from Pennsylvania and Mississippi. So a wonderful learning experience.
That would be a big change. Okay. So you now you make your move over to Tennessee. You're already aware that people from Tennessee are coming into Mississippi specifically for illegally sourced paddlefish. Who are these people that are coming over, by the way? It's locals?
You know, they were dealers that were set up in the state of Tennessee, and people would come from all over wherever paddlefish occurred, and we later learned sturgeon as well. They'd come to these fish dealers, or these fish dealers would go out and solicit. They'd show, just like what happened in Mississippi, by really developing the market, encouraging the fishery, because these folks, based on contacts in New York, had learned that, hey, there's a demand for these eggs because they look so close to the Russian stuff.
Interesting.
And they could make a substantial profit over what they would make in the normal commercial fishing activities, you know, for catfish or something like that, that they would, and these are gill netters, mostly.
Okay.
And, interestingly with that, the state of Tennessee had a legal fishery with a prescribed season, limits, but they always, from the time they started it, that fishery, they had a reporting requirement.
Okay.
So, as soon as I got to Tennessee, I began to pull those records and look at them. And I saw so many disparities. In a paper trail investigation, you know, they can be intriguing, but they can be mind-boggling as well.
Numbing.
So starting to compare reported harvest with reported acquisition from the dealers, began to see just these huge fluctuations, determined that, yeah, this is not accurate. So the next step was, let's see who people are contacting. So as gathering intelligence, you know, going back to the basis of everything we, and I'm including you in this, we, Ed, I mean, everything we do, we want to have as much intelligence as possible. We want to know as much about the people as we possibly can.
Right. So what'd you find out? Who were these people that were driving the trade?
You know, we identified the dealers through who had, just from the paperwork. And we began to, with these discrepancies, we had met the threshold to subpoena phone records.
Okay.
So in this was the time when it would arrive 5 inches deep, right, paper, that stuff with the holes along the edges that, you know, would fold over itself. You get a stack of that from the phone company.
Right.
So you're going through these things manually. So I spent about 4 months doing that and realized that during the legal season, there are people that would be contacting the dealers. But right, during the illegal season, a lot, and the fish aren't gravid, don't have eggs year round, but they're still viable early before the season and sometimes after it, depending upon weather and water and things like that.
Okay.
So ultimately began to see a number of contacts taking place after the season.
Okay.
And thought, well, this is bizarre. So we continued to get complaints from fisheries biologists, and this is vital in wildlife law enforcement, that we have to oftentimes rely on biological data and biologists as well to get their take. They're the professionals when it comes to the species management.
Right.
I'm a cop. And so they begin to notice, though, through surveys of fish sampling and things that they would do pursuant to their research, that numbers were down. They didn't feel as if, or they felt as if there was a lot of undue pressure. And what was so interesting, because the biologist at that time, the commercial fisheries biologist, had to have a conversation regularly with these dealers.
Uh-huh.
Well, they began to rat to him about other dealers.
Okay. So, and the dealers are telling the biologists that there's nefarious activities taking place, right?
Yes.
So
let's not us, if you know.
Yeah, right. Thing. Exactly. So let's jump ahead a little bit so that you know now you're on to something. Are these these people, though, that are driving the trade, they're not from Tennessee, right? I mean, who's ultimately interested in these eggs, right?
This is what was so fascinating about looking at the phone records, was you'd see fishermen, whether in legal season or closed season, their conversations with these dealers. And then you'd see the dealers in Tennessee, who were called wholesale fish dealers at the time. They, in turn, were having numerous conversations with multiple companies in New York. Uh-huh. There were some in Chicago, some in California, as well as Florida. So we started looking at those companies and realizing that, of course, there's no domestic market for these things in Tennessee to speak of.
Right.
Everything is going into interstate commerce. And with that, began to realize, when we looked into these dealers in New York and elsewhere,
right,
that a lot of these have strong connections, strong ties to former Soviet Union countries. Uh-huh. And, you know, New York was and is the hub of it, with large concentrations of Russians, Ukrainians, you know, all living together in Brighton Beach in and around these high impact areas.
Right. Okay. But, so you've uncovered now the commercial driver, and as our listeners will know from talking to other guests, it's commercialization of wildlife that can often drive it to, you know, becoming threatened or becoming extinct. So now you've discovered this, you know, this commercial aspect to it. You know, you now have Russians involved. Presumably they're trying to find replacements for the diminishing supply of beluga, et cetera, Sevruga, all the sturgeons out of Eastern Europe. So And now you've got Lacey Act potential charges because you've got state violations followed by interstate commerce. So you now have a federal felony to be involved in. So now you've got to deal with these Russians. You know, in order to protect paddlefish in the U.S., you got to deal with these Russians. What's the plan? What are you going to do?
You know, this is when the more the interesting work takes place during the operation. So in 1998, we joined forces with Fish and Wildlife Service and created a storefront operation, bona fide business. And that business was an import-export company.
Wow.
Now, I have to share with you at the beginning of this, when you're brainstorming with your supervisor and your team and everybody, what can be our approach? You know, why are they going to sell to us?
Right.
And all the fishermen at that time knew that the dealers would take it and sell it in New York for a substantial profit.
Right.
We know that some Russians had circulated around through the area from some reports. So we're having this brainstorming session, and I said, what the hell? I'll be Alexander Ivanov. I'll pose as a Russian to the Americans.
And wow.
I had a boss at the time. He was one of those that would be like, that's never going to work. That's never going to work. You know, and I'm like, God damn it. Don't tell me that. Right. We're going to make this, you know, we're going to give it our all.
Right.
So anyways, yeah, we started Eurasian Trading Associates.
And okay. I got to stop you here because number one, you launch right off into an undercover business, which is probably one of the most difficult labor intensive ways to do an undercover case because you're running a business. It's an undercover business, but you still have to be responsible for all the money that comes in and goes out. You're running a storefront to the public, to anybody who's driving around or coming into the store. It looks like a totally legit business, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not easy.
You know, we had it's not easy. The amount of work the first year, I didn't take a day off. I was at storefront or on the road trying to buy every day.
Right.
And with during the creation of this thing, we wanted to be believable. We wanted the people from the Southeast to ultimately get word about us, come to us, and come in and in their minds interact with a bona fide Russian that's going to be buying my caviar. So we had to have the whole place look. A funny story, I had like a whiteboard behind me with fake orders and everything written in Cyrillic and had all sorts of notes in Cyrillic. And one of the questions we asked was, what if the real Russians show up? And we're like, nah. We'll deal with that when it gets here. Let's get these guys because they're doing the damage. We'll, you know, and if anybody understands, we're in Fish and Wildlife, we're not like the FBI. We're not like the DEA or any of the other alphabet agencies that have these huge budgets and have an incredible support team. It's going to be a handful of us tops, and that's on a good day. So with that, we decided that we were going to launch this business and send out a flyer that, hey, we're a licensed buyer, and we're here. We were relying on, when we did that, a lot of the intelligence from the biologist indicated, you know, dealers snitching on dealers. And it's very cutthroat with a fluctuating market. So we thought, well, there's not much loyalty in this. Right. So people are always looking to get more. They naturally, in any commercial entity, those that are the initial taker, I feel strongly that, you know, they always feel like they could be making more. They're putting their neck on the line. They could be making more. So that's who we wanted to appeal to. And then some of the fishermen and then some of the dealers. And let's just see what happens.
Right. So you're initially targeting the people who are doing the illegal fishing and they're bringing it to your business to sell. So you've got them on commercialization, presumably bringing Mississippi fish over into Tennessee for your federal charges. Let me ask you this. That's a big risk to take to portray a Russian, write things on a board in Cyrillic, and kind of with the idea of, hey, we'll just wing it if the Russians show up. Let me, you know, most you are a very experienced undercover officer. So
I was a kid then, not the smartest thing ever.
Well, but nonetheless, you're very good. And, you know that one of the things you have to do when you set up an undercover persona is there has to be some element of truth to it. So what was your plan? How were you going to portray a Russian? Do you have Russian background, or how are you going to play this? I mean, one thing that helps is you are not a Tennessee, Mississippi boy, right? You don't hear it in your voice. And so,
right.
You know, right away, at least with the locals, obviously you're not from there. So that's a good start. But how are you going to play off being a Russian?
I went to the bookstore, Ed, and they had a tape on the clearance bin. And in the clearance bin was a tape called Just Enough Russian. So I get this tape, and it's a man and a woman engaging in Russian dialogue with common phrases. And I came back with, I'm going to talk like that guy. That's what I'm going to sound like when he speaks English. I'm going to sound like him. So I did my damnedest to mimic that person's English speaking from the Just Enough Russian tape. And I mean, and this is part of the obsessive stuff with UC to be successful. I listened to probably hundreds of hours of it constantly. I would go home to or go to a hotel or whatever. I would put that in and just listen to it and repeat phrases. Wow. And I thought, this got to work. And, you know, bought some silky, shiny pants and running suits and pointy-toed shoes and the typical gangster crap. And like, yeah, that's just what I'll wear. Fortunately, had a very convincing undercover vehicle that was, you know, not of American origin or anything at all like that. Let's be convincing.
It does help if you're going to portray a Russian to wear a tracksuit, at least at that time. especially the ones in, the ones involved in crime. That seemed to be their preferred outfit the matching tracksuit with maybe some gold.
Remind me.
Do you have any gold chains to go with it?
We'll come back to it if there's time. There's a good tracksuit story that is tied into it from a trip with the Russians. But, you know, we wanted to get these, the takers and the dealers. We thought if we can get to them, put them over a barrel, hopefully that's going to give us enough to tie into the Russians. We didn't, we weren't sure if we would, in fact, you know, be able to deal with them, new face. And we knew, of course, we're not going to deal with them as Russians. That just obviously wouldn't fly.
Yeah.
So during the storefront, we began to garner through undercover contacts. On this operation, I think we had maybe 1,800 plus recordings.
Wow.
So, and these were all, you know, phone calls, no texting at the time.
Right.
But began to go out and meet the fishermen and began to have a better understanding of the organizational structure of who kind of controls a specific area. Because we found that there were kind of like these sub buyers who they directed fishermen to go. They would come up with the way to cover closed season. Perhaps if the state of Kentucky was open, they would buy a license in Kentucky and say, these are Kentucky eggs. Right. And we began to, as this was developing and we're buying caviar, so I had to develop a taste and act like I knew what I was doing with this.
Right.
You know, Ed, I don't eat chicken eggs, let alone a damn fish egg. How am I going to do this without gag reflex kicking in and be convincing and, you know, and say something back with an accent that, oh God, this is the best I've ever had. And, you know, make them love you.
That's tough.
That was some of the hardest part, putting the shit in my mouth. Yeah. And telling them how good it is. So, it was as it evolved.
I get it.
Yeah. And they began to tell us though about what their other dealers had coached them to do. And this is where we're getting into knowledge and establishing their culpability and seeing that a lot of the trafficking that was happening was, in fact, directed by these Tennessee and other southeastern level dealers.
Okay.
they would coach them, get that out-of-state license. And wow. One day with one of them, something really interesting happened. There was an individual we ended up buying thousands of pounds from, and he would collect it from various people, but he got so comfortable with me, he'd have them over to meet the Russian.
Nice.
And so here I could talk to them in my pseudo accent and say, oh, you make very good egg. Is this, you know, yours? And yep, caught it yesterday. And I'm going, yes, I know, because surveillance had you on the river in Tennessee closed. So things were coming together. Keeping track of it was the hard part. And one day I went to this specific dealer and we went in and he had the caviar processed. And he said, I have something special to show you. And he opens up the container and the caviar was distinctly different. It was a much lighter color and much larger eggs. Huh. And I said to him, oh, this is beautiful. This is what I'd love. And he says, now, this is endangered. It was a sturgeon out of the Mississippi River.
Whoa, nice.
And I'm like, oh, did your other dealer coached you or told you well how to separate the eggs? He goes, oh, yeah, he made sure of that. And he always paid us more. So nice. Those recordings play well against the dealer. Those recordings, of course, play well against the defendant.
Absolutely.
And so we found that they would open up and want to tell the Russians how clever they were.
Right. They're almost bragging now about their skill at being illegal, yeah. Right?
Yeah, totally. And this is none of that was very instant. That was first year and a half.
Okay.
You know, it took, we use the phrase, you know, when we do our training, they had to progress their way to the dance with the bad guy, you know? So it's just a matter of buying legal, not asking too many questions, yeah. and gaining their trust.
Right.
It got to the point that we had so much in, and we realize, you know, we're buying, we have to sell.
Yeah.
Okay. And as the government at that time, so the storefront ran from 98 to 2000, almost 2002.
Okay.
So 4 years.
Wow.
But as the government, it's incumbent upon us to put public safety first.
Right.
So anything that we would buy, we would send to the forensic lab to identify species to make sure, because sometimes you're looking at all these eggs. But also, we were having random lots tested for contaminants.
Right.
Throughout the drainage. And, you know, we don't want to be responsible for this. So we exercise as government due diligence as much as we possibly can. Right. We had this caviar and we were beginning to, the funds were running low, and I'm sitting in the storefront one day. And one of the informal ways Russians would answer the phone would be alo, like kind of like hello. And right. So I'm like, I can do that because the guy on the tape told me I can talk that way. And so I answer the phone at the store and I say, alo. And the guy on the other end of the line says, alo.
Oh, shoot.
And I'm like, all I could think of, Ed, was hold.
Yeah. Oh,
and
shit.
I set the phone
That's
up.
An oh shit moment.
Took about
the Russians have reached out to you. Now what?
Yes. And I didn't feel like anybody was going to show up because here we are nestled, you know, kind of in a town on the Tennessee-Georgia line,
right.
Not endorsing the band, but that's where we were at. I guess we were the first ones. Okay. And anyways, this guy on the other line, I'm like, oh my God. All right, deep breaths. Came on with my regular voice and I said, hello, this is John. Can I help you? And the guy asked, who was that? And I said, oh, that's Ivanov. He had to go to the other room and get something. The guy's like, okay. He begins to talk to me, this Russian from New York.
Nice.
Says, can you send me a sample?
And nice.
Absolutely. We'll send you a sample. You'd FedEx it overnight. The guy, they tasted our sample, looked at it and said, okay, we want like 100 pounds.
Whoa.
And at the time, maybe $55 a pound, 100 pounds. So yeah, we can get it to you. We began to just move the row and have conversations with these, with the Russians. And we were reliable, and because of the people we were getting it from, I think we had probably some of the best stuff out there.
Nice.
We so wanted let me, the other. Yeah, go ahead.
Let me, there's a couple things I want to just talk about here because it's important for you and I know exactly what you're talking about, but listeners might not. So for one of the terms you're using is roe, and just so people know, that's fish eggs. Roe is fish eggs, also yeah. Caviar. But, you know, so we're running an undercover business. A lot of times, undercover businesses are just set up to buy contraband. But if you're going to run one for a long time, and if this one went for 4 years, you also sometimes have to sell. And I've done that too, where I've run an undercover business where I'm buying and selling, or I'm just selling, but sometimes selling is important. But I've never run a business where I had a consumable item, right? And your right. point is very well taken. You're selling fish caviar. And so buying it is one thing. If you're buying contraband, making your building your cases against these local people who are illegally fishing and then the brokers who are bringing it to you, you don't have to worry about public safety because you're just buying. But when you turn around right. and start to sell a consumable, that is you know, kudos to you, number one, for thinking about it. But of course, because you're the government, you have to take those, you're held to an even higher standard. You have to make sure that, you know, your processing facilities are clean, you meet all the right state standards, all the federal standards for producing a food product and packaging it. Because God forbid, there's some listeria breakout that is linked to
yes.
an undercover business, right? Crazy, crazy.
Exactly.
So
always at the edge of your seat.
Yeah.
Pins and needles all the time.
Totally, pins and needles. Yeah. But at the same time, you got to do it in order to look legit. At some point,
right.
you got to be selling. And once those Russians reach out to you, you got to get into those Russians because now you know you've got exactly. probably organized criminal activity involving these state-protected animals.
Right.
So this is a huge break when this Russian calls you. It's also an oh shit moment because yeah. now you need to make a pivot on your undercover because you are pretending to be a Russian dude, but you don't speak Russian.
Right.
Right. So yeah, I want to ask you, I think I know how I would play this off once I realized, oh crap, we're going to have to deal with Russians. But I want to know, what did you decide to do? Like, how did you had to have made a decision at that moment? Okay, we're going to engage with Russians now. How am I going to explain that I'm a Russian dude with a Russian accent that doesn't speak Russian? How'd you explain it?
So I became John.
Oh, you did. You pivoted to a whole new character.
Yes. And this is character number two. There is one more that'll show up at the end. That's what's like we said, we're not the big alphabet agencies. We don't have all these manpower to bring these people in. So
I love this. Like, this is not what I would have done because I wouldn't have thought of it, but this is brilliant. Okay. This is good.
So yeah, John is head of regional sales for the company. And I'm glad to help you. And it just snowballed from there. John became the point of contact with the Russians.
Nice.
So
this is almost like a 70s sitcom where inevitably the scene has to happen where, what was your Russian undercover name? Yevgeny? Was it?
Alexander Ivanov.
Alexander. Ivanov. Okay. So at some point, you know, John and Alexander are supposed to be at the same dinner party and you're running in and out, changing your outfit. Anyway, yeah. So with the Russians, you transition to this new undercover persona, John. And so how does this play out? What happens? Now you're going to develop cases against Russians in New York. Anywhere else? Where else were the Russians?
You know, they directed and led a lot of that. That was the beautiful part. And that's what ultimately led me to meet Ed Newcomer. And, you know, it's out in L.A. But what was so fascinating, by day that we joked about it, by day I'd be Alex. I'd be buying caviar from the Americans. And then I transitioned to John to deal with the Russians.
Crazy.
And we started selling serious amounts. And with the, but we're like, okay, we want to get knowledge, that culpability of these guys, do they know what they're doing is illegal? We need to open that door up somehow.
Right.
So after, I don't know, sending several hundred pounds to both New York and then ultimately to Los Angeles at the direction of New York.
I see. Okay.
And they also had us, the New York contact, had us shipping it to three or four other Russians in New York.
Wow.
And okay. What they would request is just send it directly to them. But on the airway bill from FedEx, don't put that it was from you. Just put that it was from us. We want to be sure. And I'm thinking, oh, that's great. But we're going to have to interact with these other people if we're ever going to figure out, more about them.
Right.
So while packing up cab chip to them, I'd always drop a handful of business cards in the box.
Nice.
And then ultimately they started contacting us independently to get it. And everybody was behind everybody's back. During a conversation with the directing one out of New York, I asked him, because we had the interest, of course, in the Russian stuff, what is happening with this? And you'd hear about instances at JFK or LA where couriers would have it in their suitcases, and be apprehended at the port, and thinking, how's it all coming in this way? So I said to him, hey man, you're Russian. You happen to, do you get access to the Russian stuff? You could have heard a pin drop.
Really?
And he begins to tell me, first of all, yes, we get it. We have all the connections. And I'm like, at this time, I'm like losing it. I'm like, yes, awesome. This is, we're going. He begins to tell me about how they have access to a lot of it. And as a matter of fact, during that phone call, he said, we just had 2 point something tons of Kaluga. Chinese sturgeon, very similar to beluga, had a level of protection. So we just had 2 tons of it come in.
In my experience, Kaluga was often code for beluga. It actually wasn't Kaluga. It was actually beluga. And, another thing I wanted to point out is I'll try to put some photos of what caviar looks like on the Nature Secret Service webpage so people can go look. But a lot of these dealers claim they can eyeball the difference, that they're looking at, oh, that's beluga versus, it's very difficult. Yes, sometimes the eggs are a little bit bigger than other species, but in my experience, it's very difficult to eyeball. So as you were doing in this case, law enforcement often sends these to specialized labs that can do DNA testing and tell you exactly what animal it came from. And in my experience, Kaluga was often actually beluga out of the Caspian Sea or Black Sea.
And that was one thing we discussed. Is he just, he doesn't know me enough? Is he saying this Kaluga thing? And frankly, at the time, I didn't know what a Kaluga was. I'd not even heard it. So immediately, one of my first kudos out to Fish and Wildlife Service agents, Gary Phillips, was our case agent.
Okay.
And Gary was about 7 hours away from the storefront location, and he was making trips every week. Anytime I needed cover, Gary was there.
Wow. Okay, good.
One of the most solid human beings I've ever put my, my trust in to truly have my back.
Good.
Gary's an incredible guy. And so Gary, I'd call him after contact. So we'd sometimes be talking at midnight, of course.
Right.
And he said, let me get in the Fish and Wildlife Service system and see how many if there's any declarations or any import permits for Kaluga. And after I talked to this guy, found out that there was only like 1.7 kilos permitted to come in. And it was probably for some laboratory situation.
Probably, yep.
So we thought, well, this is awfully screwy, but this is, let's open up the door. And I asked the guy about it casually a few days later. He's like, man, that's gone. Mm. And I'm like, okay. So they had heard about us. Some of their friends, they weren't buying caviar from them in New York anymore. They were coming straight to us from the business card fiasco.
Right.
So they said, we need to have a meeting.
Okay.
And I said, okay, I need a, what what kind of meeting you want to have? Let's do it in New York. And we want to talk about basically securing long-term business, all this sort of thing.
Fantastic.
And I needed a partner who was going to be savvy, who had experience. And my mentor for undercover work, Dave Cartwright, rest his soul. He just passed away this past year. Dave Cartwright was a service agent at the end of his career. Matter of fact, for this, he became an annuitant and got to stay on longer to help. So I learned so much. This guy had so much incredible technique with any group. And so, Dave, could you need you to be like a business partner with the company, a financial backer, something? And he's like, count me in.
Nice.
Enthusiastically, I might add, just because that's the nature of Dave Cartwright.
A perfect situation, so, too. You got a Fed and a state officer working together. So you're going to have state laws and federal laws covered in terms of you know, experience and expertise.
That's great. Absolutely. And I've, you know, throughout my career, I've had amazing experiences working with service agents on joint cases, whether it's, you know, outfitter undercover cases in the Western U.S. or duck hunting cases or, you know, waterfowl cases kind of thing. But for the most part, I've truly enjoyed working with service agents. And
there's always a few exceptions.
Yeah, there's a few exceptions.
that'll be a different episode. We'll talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I notice I'm not on their Christmas card list either, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. That's one of those. We all know who those, and you know what? More importantly, those people know who they are too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you and Dave are going to actually go up to New York and have meetings with Russians. This is hardcore now.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us about that. And, what happens?
Well, we go to, and mind you, we had been sending at their direction, like I said, to LA as well. So we knew we had an element there. And it at this point in time, along with the four or five others in New York, trying to get amounts to them and trying to have conversations with them to get them to understand that it's close season right now. You know, if you're willing to put your neck on the line, we'll send it, but it can't, you got to cover this kind of thing. So this is going on extensively. And we knew we were going to be meeting with two of the Russians, a father and son team in Staten Island.
Okay.
So we flew in and to New York, and Cartwright was kind of the financial backer, and he was of the demographic and age, and he looked sharp. We rent this big ass boat of a Cadillac, and we cruise on out to Staten Island, and you know, just have very common conversation with the guys. We're laying eyes on them, and they're like, "We're gonna go eat." And okay, well, where are we going? said our friend of ours has a restaurant in Queens, and I'm like, okay, this sounds interesting. And what's it called? And he names the restaurant Troika. Mind you, we had a cover team, Gary Phillips from the South and a couple other folks. And we also had the team of agents in New York City.
Okay.
Who, you know, I can't stress the importance of cover teams enough. We do too many of these Lone Ranger things, and it's not best practice. It was reckless. And I was grateful to have this cover team, and especially the New York agents, because they knew the back roads. They knew where how to get around in New York.
Yeah, New York, Los Angeles, those are not easy places to run a cover team that doesn't get noticed, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so when we couldn't convey to them, we had a body wire transmitting to the cover team. And of course, that time, very limited duration of power. We didn't know how long or what. We didn't know any particulars. But fortunately, our case agent, Gary Phillips, says, you know, let's go with it. I trust him. They can decide. So we go out. The Russians from Staten Island get in the car with us, and we pull in front of a place in this restaurant. Says Troika over the door. Ironically, there's another Troika. But like, oh, okay, this seems pretty cool. Guys, who are we meeting? What's the story? And they're like, well, his name is Jan. And we're just going to have lunch with him, talk to him a little bit. And we just want to show him you guys are cool. And okay. And we want to talk to you guys about cornering the business. But more than anything, we're just looking for Jan's approval.
Okay.
So, all right. So now, I mean, you know, you're thinking this shit's amping up a little bit.
Yeah.
This
you're is moving, you're moving pretty up bizarre. The chain. Yeah. You're moving up the chain. At
yeah.
Seniority. Yeah. Okay.
We walk into the doors of this beautiful place. And as we walk into the doors, sure as shit, there's two guys standing there with the freaking nylon sweatsuits on in the lobby. And I look at Dave Cartwright, you'll hear me refer to him as. This guy had the ability as an officer or as an undercover officer to, when things would get tense, he could keep it chill.
Right.
Or he could de-escalate in such a natural way. Nice. Or he could make you laugh when you needed it.
Important skill.
So we walk in, we see these guys, and they're like, we're going downstairs. So
oh
we start to proceed down a marble staircase that continued to wind underground. It's in the basement with these brass railings. And I'm realizing at the time that our transmitter is not going to transmit out of here. We're surrounded by cement and steel. Let's go. We're going down the steps. And it's a very eerie feeling. Anybody who ever says they don't get nervous for an undercover role or contacts doesn't need to be doing it.
Exactly. You need to be nervous.
Yeah. And I'm nervous. I don't know what to expect. What's going on? We've done thousands of dollars of business with these guys. They've indicated the smuggling coming in. What else are they into? And as we're going down the stairs, you hear coming from the room a Britney Spears song. What the hell is this?
Right.
Well, it's getting even weirder at this point. And Cartwright's beside me and he looks over and he says, I've always wanted to go out like this. And I'm like, I just wanted to give him a big hug.
Yeah, he kind of read your thoughts, right? You guys are both like, oh my gosh, is this the last time I'm going to talk to anybody?
Exactly. Right? And but you know, it gave me a moment of just, yeah, breathe easy. You know, we're doing this for a reason, and we got to try to have fun with it too.
Yeah, and it's probably okay. It's probably going to be okay.
Yeah, probably okay, and. We get down there and there's a big Russian guy that we meet sitting at the table and we're the guest of the other two. So it's ultimately at the table. It's this big guy named Jan. It's our two Russians from New York and Dave and myself. And they begin to just bring vodka like it's water food and everything's brass and mirrors. And where'd the Britney Spears thing come from? That comes from on the stage where a bunch of what we believe to be underage women of former Soviet countries that were probably smuggled in.
Yeah. Human trafficked. Yeah.
They're working and being trafficked. Yeah. As part of something here. So that, you know, raises your hackles again. Things just aren't right. So ultimately we sit down and we're having just general conversation with Jan, and they pretty quickly after a few shots of vodka, they pretty quickly come around to, look, here's the thing. We know you're selling to these other guys in New York. And they're like, hey, you know, yeah, we are, but they reached out to us.
Right.
So we've got to make business and, you know, and you could die tomorrow and we're not going to be able to, we need somebody else to deal with, you know, it's just part of our business plan. And as we're trying to smooth it over, we're pushing back pretty hard.
Okay.
And they were like, at one point, we will tell you who to sell it to.
Ooh.
And it's going to be to us.
Okay.
And the instant reaction with that is no, bullshit. You're not, I mean, you could try to, but we're not going to do it that way.
Wow.
And it's getting louder and more escalated, and unbeknownst to me and unbeknownst to Cartwright, coming up behind us are the two goons in the damn sweatsuits again.
Holy shit.
And all we could think about was turn around, look at them, and, you know, be like, oh, what the hell moment. What is this shit all about? We were talking business, and you got, you know, Igor and Gunzo here over my shoulder. What? This is bullshit. We'll just leave. And ultimately, Jan, the big guy at the end of the table, puts his hand up, motions them back, and speaks Russian to them. And they came back, and they come across to us, and they said, okay, you guys are all right. Just make sure we get the most of it. You stood your ground. You can do business with us. Oof. And they're like, scary. There's going to be a lot more business coming. And mind you, as I said, the cover team outside, they're not getting any transmission.
Right. Oh yeah. You're down in a basement. That's not going to transmit. Nope.
Yeah. And we were down there for it seemed like days, but it was a few hours. And while that's going on, the cover team's out on the street, and there's other sweatsuit goons walking up and looking in the windows on the street of the vehicles, looking for anything out of sorts. Of course, Dave and I weren't aware of this. You couldn't get a cell phone signal. You couldn't get anything. Back once again to ultimately Gary Phillips' case agent was in control. He said, no, let's let him go. And I appreciate the faith and confidence he had in us. And because you can imagine what was going through his mind.
Absolutely.
We lost this. We have this going on. Guys walking up and down the street, and very, very bizarre.
Yeah.
So
they're doing counter surveillance, looking for law enforcement. Yeah, this is a super dangerous situation because this has all the earmarks of organized crime, right?
Yes, and with that, that's always, you know, that's in our mind more and more. And especially during that lunch, I feel like we got over this hurdle when they're like, okay, but you guys are going to sell mostly to us. Mm. Right after that, they motion, a guy comes out with a tray full of large blue tins. Like, yep.
Right.
What's going on, guys? And they said, this is all Russian stuff.
Beluga.
And we're like, oh, awesome. Man, you guys are rock stars. How are you able to get it in? And that's nothing we could have ever, of course, asked them at the beginning.
Right.
But how do you guys do this? And they go, we have couriers, we place orders, we have a steady source of them coming in. So we're like, wow, this is a big win to us, because we're like, here comes, you know, this stuff into the country. And they're like, man, we can really get anything you guys want.
Nice. And by this time, Beluga is completely prohibited under CITES rules and certainly coming under ESA, although not quite yet. But CITES had shut down the trade on Beluga. Yeah.
Yeah, the best I remember. And
yeah, so I think
the
only thing that was allowed was there was a personal baggage exception, which allowed you, I think, bring in like 250 grams or something like that. Small amount.
I remember.
Basically, yeah, two tins per person. So there's a whole other topic of how they couriered stuff in using the exceptions. But yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. And we're like, well, you know, if you guys are buying all of our stuff, what's the need for this? And they're like, the true Russians want this. They pay dearly for this. And we're like, well, what is the demand for all the paddlefish roe? You know, because like we told them, you know, like, hey, we know some folks who could, this could probably be sold as Russian. Yeah. And they're like, that's what we do. And we're like, oh, you do? Where do you make it? Or how do you do this? They're like, we do it in our basement.
Yep.
And they're like, we take what we buy from you. It goes into our tins, and we sell it all over to the Russian population and connoisseurs of the stuff. They think it's Russian. And I'm like, but Beluga is substantially larger. Well, what do you guys sell it as? And they're like, we sell it as Savruga.
Savruga. Yeah.
So, you know,
it's a little bit smaller.
Yeah. And it was still the Russian product, looked very similar to it. And so we're feeling very good at this point in time, because that was one of the early bits of intel that I neglected to mention earlier, that was that we think it's being sold as Russian, because, you know, the Russian stuff has a prohibition. Yep. Like, well, we'd love to prove it. So we said to made a simple request. Could you guys send us some of the tens? We want to put them in the stores like a display of caviar things. Yeah. Like, absolutely. And they sent us home with a bunch of their cans.
Nice. That say on the outside, they say Sevruga, but you can then test it and find out it's actually Paddlefish Row.
And the best thing was where it would say product of Russia or product of Astrakhan or Astrakhan Fisheries. And Malasol, Russian, low salt, everything written in Cyrillic, the picture of the salmon, listen to me, of the sturgeon, it's all coming together.
Nice.
And so as we begin to, the relationship continues, and we end up meeting the New York, the folks from New York, we ended up meeting them in LA. Where we first met Ed and back to another, you know, amazing cover team. And the legwork that you did on your side, giving us the intel from, I think it was California Bureau of Justice, that we were going into a mob joint where they used to watch people get the hell kicked out of them in the back.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly. We teamed up with a Russian speaking agent from the California Department of Justice. And just a side story. I think we have about 10 minutes left, but I think we can finish up the story, I think, in about 10 minutes.
Sorry, I get long-winded.
Oh, this is a good story. I'm trying to think if we should break it into two, but I think we can finish up what happened in about 10 minutes, don't you think, Sean?
I think. Okay, cool.
I think so.
Yeah.
There was a Russian there is a Russian area of kind of West Hollywood, and we found out that one of your target places here in West Hollywood was known to, like, people were getting beat up and thrown in the trunks of black Cadillacs and in the middle of the night and driven off, and nobody ever knew what happened to those people. So this was not.
Yeah.
And in fact, I don't know if you were about to tell this, but didn't these Russians at some point in New York think about offing you?
Well, we discovered it within the recordings in the heated argument. As I was talking about when we were insisting that we'll sell to who we want to sell to, and it's getting loud. We had transcribers and translators from that were Department of State certified. And they would take the recordings and translate the Russian.
Okay.
So during that heated conversation in New York, the one that ultimately the big guy, you know, suppressed and said, okay, everything's cool. We were playing it back because we wanted to know what they were talking about and negotiating.
Yeah, right in front of you, but they're talking about it right in front of you, but in Russian. Okay.
Exactly.
What did they say?
And one of the things, of course, that came back in the translation was, maybe we should just kill these guys and take the business.
Shit.
And this was about, we got the recordings back a few weeks later, or the transcriptions back a few weeks later. And I remember Gary calling me, Phillips. He's like, hey, I just want to share this with you. This is what they're hearing at this portion. And, you know, of course, my initial reaction, I'm like, those sons of bitches, you know, and frustrated and like, all right, now they're really going to get it.
But at the same time,
brought it home.
That brings it home, right? Right in front of you, these guys are talking about potentially killing you. Yeah.
And, you know, Ed, as a bit of a side thing, and you can relate to this, this is one of those situations that people, especially a lot of administrators, they don't understand what their officers are being put through, what their agents are going through.
Right.
And sadly, a lot of times these are the ones that are making policies, and they won't draw from the experience of those who were in the trenches, so to speak, in doing it. Mm. And, you know, not until very recently has it become a normal thing for some UK law enforcement, U.S. law enforcement, to have their undercovers evaluated psychologically from time to time.
Right.
I wish that had been available when I was on this. Thing is, they probably would have locked me up in the nervous hospital. But, so, you know, well, it's
You know, this goes also to this thing. I think a lot of officers and also supervisors, people in higher in the chain of command, they assume that these people are not that dangerous because they're just dealing in wildlife. Certainly, you know, yep. prosecutors and judges sometimes have that bias where, oh, it's just wildlife. But it's not. It's money. Yeah. It's money, and it's freedom. It's their liberty. And yeah, these guys stood to make a lot of money in the caviar business. And if they're prone to violence anyway, they're not going to care about a couple of guys from Tennessee who are trying to make, you know, business problems for them. Yeah,
exactly. And so that really that hit home, hit hard.
Yeah.
So we had to be extra mindful in our future dealings with them. And, you know, a specific instance flying out to LA for this. And we had from you received the information that you learned about the location being organized crime, questionable activities from California Department of Justice.
Right.
So we had that in mind. And I pick up a USA Today at the airport to read on the plane, on the flight to LA. And sure as hell, in the second page of it is Mafia, M-A-F-I-Y-A, hoods take on America. And it's talking about the neighborhoods where we were working.
Yep.
I'm like, well, this is a, maybe Cartwright's going to get his wish yet. And so nonetheless, it leads us to L.A. and in the business in L.A. because we want to establish that knowledge. And these people that, you know, especially dealing with foreigners, whether it's traditional Chinese medicine or whatever the case is, they say, I didn't understand what they were saying. I didn't understand. And it's an easy out.
Yep.
If it's incumbent upon us to establish that knowledge and come to a way that we show that they understand.
Yep.
And the individual in LA in his business, there's the tins from New York that he's selling his Russian caviar. And he's telling us about how it all works. And I said, you just got to be careful. And I pulled him aside and I said, just be careful. Don't be telling anybody that you're getting it from us or anything at all like that. And one of my favorite recordings of that guy, he says, I'll tell them I make it in my pool. What are they going to do? And I'm like, okay, you're locked in.
Okay.
So, but just, you know, trying to get knowledge from everybody, the be careful is the, how's all this?
So but you were able to. No, that's okay. You were able to draw out those incriminating statements from everybody in New York and L.A.
Yes.
Nice.
And we had two people left on the list that we wanted to get to before the end of the operation.
Okay.
And we've not been able to deal with them with our existing covers. So cover number three. Become a commercial fisherman, pose as a commercial fisherman. These are my eggs.
Okay.
And the next thing, New Year's Eve, Gary Phillips and I end up in a snowstorm in the middle of Illinois, meeting a Russian with the hand tattoos and all the crap, who we later learned was on the radar of the FBI in Chicago for the longest time.
Whoa.
Okay. And for his various nefarious acts in life.
Right.
And it was interesting with him. His English was not good. And now I'm talking as a redneck. So third cover
yep.
in this thing, I'm trying to sell him eggs that I caught. And Gary and I are in the vehicle with him. I'm like, don't tell anybody where this came from, Alex. The season's closed. I can't go to jail. I, you know, all the things.
Yep.
And he would just look at me and say, no talk. And I'm like, no shit. I'm telling you, be careful. And about the third time, I thought he was going to rip his steering wheel off. And he said, I said, no talk. I'm like, okay, I think he gets it. So
yeah, that's not exactly great incriminating statements from him.
Yeah.
Two words, right? Don't talk. It's better than nothing.
So what we did, we sent an agent in Chicago, Dave Kirkby, went to the guy's business in Chicago, bought some caviar Perfect. That they had in for sale. We had Kirkby simply ask him, what am I buying here? My wife, this is our anniversary or some story along those lines. I want something special. Like, no, this is Russian. This is all Russian caviar.
Perfect.
And what he ended up purchasing, we tested and it was our paddlefish.
Nice.
Right. Okay. So that's how we had to shore that guy up on the other end, bringing in another agent and the support throughout this case from agents all over the country that were either cover teams or search warrant teams, right, whatever the case may be. I remember having in the Nashville Fish and Wildlife Service, at any given time, we'd have 8 agents in there listening to recordings at the end of the operation because I couldn't keep up with the reports.
Yeah. Right.
So we were so grateful for the service involvement and support in so many ways with it. But one thing I amazingly learned, though, from you, buddy, was writing the most comprehensive affidavits ever. And this lesson I learned from Ed Newcomer and, you know, paid off the rest of my career. And ultimately, those templates or boilerplates for language and for writing warrants are now used in several states for murder cases and their search warrants. But I attribute this to you, man. And I'm so grateful for that because there's a science and an art to writing those things and getting an AUSA to buy into it.
Why did I write the warrants for out in LA or something? I don't even remember.
We've sent you the PC and there was lots of questions, of course, from your AUSA working with our AUSA and formats that had to be in LA and all of that. And just, so I remember the one guy, I think it was like 100 pages or so. Yeah, and but that was all you're doing.
I don't even remember that. I didn't remember that I even wrote the warrants on the LA cases, but now it's possible. Probably. I mean, I think I do recall that I was fairly new, but I had, so it's likely that that stuff would have been assigned to me. But I do remember I was assigned to make one of the arrests on out in LA, and it was my very first arrest as a federal agent. Awesome. I know out in LA we hooked up 3 people were charged out in LA. How did this all wrap up? What kind of cases did you make and against who?
So ultimately when it was said and done, we had well over 100 fishermen with violations.
Wow.
Those were state violations. Right. We had to let the statute of limitations ride on that because it was 1 year.
Right. Oh,
okay. If we couldn't get them looped into the conspiracy side of things, we just weren't going to. So we said, this will be a strong enough deterrent when their buyers get prosecuted.
Exactly.
Out of all of the, I think it was 19 defendants that were high tier traffickers, was what we ended up prosecuting. We had one trial lasted about 2 weeks.
Okay.
And that was on the original family that started it all, Royal Off Caviar out of Chattanooga, Tennessee, a guy by the name of Hale.
Okay.
He's since passed on, I believe. But him and his family, trial. And what was interesting throughout all the search warrants we began to see on the dealers in America, they would record false names. Yeah. So false records under Lacey Act. We began to attribute that and tie that into it. And they were blatant about it. Like Mickey Mouse sold us this. we found in the industry that people would pimp their daughters out and then hold it over the head of a married fisherman. We found in the industry from the Russians, we began to get high-end counterfeit goods that they were also dealing with in New York. Right. And we were swapping that for caviar as well. The things that they were coming up with at the time, the predecessor of Homeland Security, I think they were called Customs.
Yeah,
US Customs. So everything would go to the Customs Lab, and Customs Lab came back with this is some most high quality stuff that we'd ever seen. So it was great. We brought in other agencies. We had a tremendous AUSAs, and we had support all over the country from people when it came time to take it down. At the, I think the final, everybody either was found guilty or pled guilty.
Nice.
Except for one family member who played an incidental role, and they didn't, we weren't able to get him tied into it much.
Okay, but, so he wasn't even charged, but otherwise you had 100% conviction rates.
Yeah, he was charged, in all fairness. He was charged, and I think he got some sort of diversion situation or something. I can't remember what it was, but everybody else got hit with the felony Lacey Acts. Nice. We explored RICO. We met elements for RICO. we were looking at, you know, wire fraud, all of the things. But ultimately, with the attorneys, they had some high power ones. The guys in LA, they had a guy who was an attorney, ESPN's attorney during the OJ Simpson trial, and he was their commentator. So, you know, he's coming back to Tennessee because we had venue. That was the offended venue. And we had a great AUSA who was a, he was a, an agent at USA prior to his time. He was a state investigator. And then he ultimately became an AUSA. So he was great to work with. And
after this was all over, did you notice a difference? Did it, was there a change? Is there less pressure on the paddlefish? What did you see was the outcome?
So the dealers, yes, they, for a period of time, they were severely limited because some of them went to prison. I think we had 24 months on the Hales, nice. The federal lockup, lots of probation dealers, things like that. So things calmed way down. But a really interesting thing that did happen, I heard about it after the fact on the Ohio River in Indiana, a couple of Russians, bona fide Russians, showed up trying to buy from people.
Yep.
And this was in another state, but the people wouldn't deal with them. They're like, no, you're undercovers.
Interesting. That's what you want.
The rollover effect that we had.
That's what you want.
But all in all, things went really quiet for a period of time, and then it began to experience another resurgence. Where we prosecuted a few more people overtly, of course, at that time. But all said and done, I think there was 19 defendants, most of them out of New York. We had the dealers out of the South. And I feel like what we were able to uncover was improved regulations, improved reporting, more stringent accountability for the industry.
Right.
And that was a direct result of the operation and what we knew and what we learned. Ultimately, the search warrants in New York and in LA, they recovered those same tens that were full of paddlefish.
Yep.
In New York, it just like they said in their basement, there were freezers full of smuggled stuff that you could oftentimes tell by the cans would have chipped paint, but on the Russian ones, but then they'd have the duplicates and the labels that were made right there in New York.
Yep.
So what we went into the operation with the goal to understand what's happening with this. Is it being falsely labeled? Is it just being sold as paddlefish? And they laid it out for us so much so I would get calls. This is like cocaine here. We need more. Can you get more? I'm like, it's the middle of the summer. They're not even gravid right now.
Right.
And, you know, so the demand was incredible. And along with that, a number of the individuals post-conviction or throughout the prosecutorial process began to cooperate.
Yeah.
And open eyes to other things.
Yeah, I was going to say, your case actually led to the development of some informants in Los Angeles that I worked those informants for years after you did your takedowns on this case in 2003-04. And
yeah,
I worked those informants for years, and it led to multiple other caviar cases in the Los Angeles area and on the West Coast involving Russians out here. So it's a lot of times it's just a matter of whack-a-mole. We whack down a certain organization for a while, and it takes the pressure off the species, and then it comes back and we got to whack them again. But Sean, I think this is an incredible story, and I think there's more to talk about with regard to caviar, not just paddlefish, but the American sturgeon and the sturgeon that occur in the Columbia River as well as the Sacramento River. And there are some other state and federal officers who've worked on caviar cases before. There's more to talk about, and I'm sure we will revisit this on future episodes. Tell us a little bit, just briefly, what is WETA doing? And, you know, if anybody wants to learn more or donate, you can go to WETATrain.org and see the website. But tell us a little bit about what you're doing there in Zambia.
Absolutely. I mean, we were founded in 2018. We ultimately evolved into a 501c3 nonprofit organization. My wife, Steph, who is been in law enforcement for 20 plus years in the state of Colorado as a wildlife law enforcement and a wildlife biologist. She's our executive director. I'm director of training and investigations. And over that time, we have trained over 3,000, whether it be rangers, investigators, prosecutors, or magistrates.
Nice.
In about, incredible. I think, 8 countries in Africa, along with Ecuador in South America. And in addition to that, we're, you know, trying to line up new places all the time. We've got, I'll put our team up against any organization out there. We've got, of course, you're our international law enforcement advisor, the experience that you have internationally, along with federal law, and just your tactics and your approach are so genuine. We're so grateful to have you on the team. And we have a couple other team members, Walter Duran, former Fish and Wildlife Service agent, and Jim Karani, one of Africa's first wildlife lawyers.
That's right.
So he's a Kenyan becoming Dr. Jim in New York City right now.
That's
you know, we're a small, but passionate and dedicated team.
Yeah, it's amazing considering how, you know, your size to have trained that many people in that sort of time. It's incredible. You know, internationally, training is something that's really needed and valued, especially when it comes from people who know what they're doing, which you guys do. So, you know, thank you for doing that. Again, it's Wildlife Investigators Training Alliance, and you can visit the website at wedatrain.org. Hey, Sean, I really appreciate you being with us today. That'll do it for this episode of Nature's Secret Service. I want to thank Sean Carnes so much for your time. I appreciate it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in for a long one, and we'll see you next time. Nature's Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturessecretservice.com.